everyone. Welcome to the End Credits Radio Show here on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFU.ca, Guelph Campus and Community Radio. I am Adam A. Donaldson, and joining me today is...
Vince Masson.
Vince, we're back!
We are back.
We made it to 2018.
We made it past some really bad films, some really good ones. It's time to start the cycle all over again, I guess.
Very well said. End Credits is your local movie show for local movie fans, and we are here every Thursday at 10 a.m. to talk the latest in pop culture and review the newest movies, which this week will be the new comedy drama from Alexander Payne called Downsizing. Now, that's in the back half of the show, and for the first half of the show, we're going to do something a wee bit different, and we're going to review a second film, or is that the first film?
Take your pick, either or. They're equally bad, so let's just, you know, whatever.
Spoiler.
Okay, sorry.
But yeah, so we were going to, first thing off the top here is do a second review. Normally we talk about news and what's going on in the movie world and that kind of thing. But something completely different from Downsizing was released over the holiday break, and it is this movie called Bright, and it is on Netflix right now. And we are going to start... how we always start with a review, and that is with a clip.
Rodriguez!
Hey.
Oh, man, I thought you were dead.
Nah, man, too many bills to pay.
Yeah, I hear you.
I thought you were out having your, like, zillionth baby.
Ah, nah, man, Marisol's a week late. We're in Ducey next week, though. Number five.
Five.
Out of mouths to feed.
Yeah, man.
Sir, drop the sword.
You! The army of nine races fought shoulder to shoulder to give you the world you neglect.
Hey, tell him to shut up.
Years ago, we fought sir.
With swords and arrows. And now the Dark One returns to reclaim orc hearts.
Everywhere I go, live orcs always gotta be the bad guys.
Historical precedent?
Maybe.
So that is a clip from Bright. It is the new film by David Ayer. It stars Will Smith, Joel Edgerton, Noomi Rapace, Lucy Fry, and Edgar Ramirez. So it's complicated. This movie is about two street cops in L.A.
Correct.
One is human.
Correct.
And the other is part of a... shall we say, undermined group, racial group that has been cast as quite villainous to society for decades, if not centuries, the orcs.
Yes. no thematic relevancy there at all.
Yes. You know, it hits you over the top right away because it opens with this, like, montage of L.A. and street art and all these, like, spray-painted stencils of police beating orcs and, you know, all the things about the Dark Lord coming back and Orc Lives Matter. And
so I guess Joel Edgerton's character, the orc, is the first one to kind of infiltrate or penetrate that human hostility to become a police officer. So there's this kind of very cliched tension between Will Smith and the orc that he doesn't trust.
And the orc's name is Nick Jacoby, too, which is struck me as kind of, I want to say kind of like an ethnic name, Jacoby. There's kind of a Jewish angle there, too. Which...
It gives off a quality of kind of, I'm not sure how to describe it. Something just otherworldly, maybe? Is that fair to say?
Well, it's just he has a very human name because, you know, it's... typically when you're like doing in the D&D world or Lord of the Rings, orcs don't have first and last names. It's like Olaf the Bloodslayer or something silly like that. So yeah, it's kind of got this Training Day vibe, but it's set in this like world where magic is real, and you know, you got orcs kind of as a lower class, you have elves as kind of like a higher class, kind of one percenter class, and it's an interesting idea, and it's one that I'm surprised no one thought of, because, you know, usually magic and stuff is, you know, it's usually, you know, medieval kind of setting or ancient kind of setting. It's quite or you know, if it isn't a modern something like Constantine, it's like shh, it's a secret.
Yes,
that there's magic. Don't tell anyone. So it's a bit unusual in that respect.
With that being said, for me, it just gets so goofy, like, so quickly, man. Like, you've got grown adults, professional actors talking about, we need to find the wand. We need to find... It's like, really? You're, like, this is... Like, I couldn't do that with a straight face, man. We're making a movie featuring a magic wand, and we're all grown adults pretending to be serious about it. I'm sorry, I just couldn't do it. And here's the other thing, okay? I respect David Ayer, I think, more than I admire his, like, artistic achievements.
Okay.
Talking about a veteran of the U.S. Navy, we're talking about a guy who mortgaged his house to pay for his first film, Harsh Times, in 2005. No surprise that that kind of more gritty, character-driven thing is actually my favorite thing that he's done. And it just strikes me that he had this niche going of the... You know, the very marketable kind of cop thrillers, you know what I mean? Like, he obviously carved a niche for himself, I feel, after Training Day, you know, that whole research.
Or something like Fury, even, which is about guys in a tank, which is gritty. It's like gritty war, not a conventional war movie in sense, because you don't typically see who's in the tanks.
Right, yes. And I feel like he's just getting so far from his wheelhouse now. I'm not even sure. I mean, he was never what I would say, like, a great director. He was always, he was more of like an action kind of marketable director. He was not really, his strengths, I feel, are not really in characters or like dialogue or, you know, everything, basically. No, I'm just kidding. So, again, like, he's done some, like, very good work, but I don't know. I just feel like with the Suicide Squads and this now, it's like maybe it's time to go back to what you know.
Yeah. Well, he of course, didn't write this. Max Landis.
Right, Max Landis, who wrote Chronicle, you know what I mean?
Yeah, he wrote Chronicle and Victor Frankenstein.
He's obviously got an affinity for, like, real world mixed with kind of sci-fi stuff, just based on his previous stuff.
Yes. I think we're kind of reaching the end of the coattails of Chronicle, though. I think he gets a lot of leeway for that. But because I think there's such a terrible mixture of tones with this. Sometimes it's like you're watching the magical version of In the Heat of the Night, and then other times it's like you're watching the magic version of Lethal Weapon.
Mm-hmm.
And it swings wildly back and forth. And there's the scene at the beginning of the film where they're in, like, roll call, and you know, the other cops are kind of like mocking the orc cop, Nick.
Yeah.
And they're like, you know, they're showing him pictures of, you know, like orcs that have been arrested. Like, hey, isn't this your cousin? Which is like, it has like very immediate, obvious racial overtones. Like, all orcs look like, basically, is what this other cop was saying. And then, you know, they're in their cruiser, and, you know, kind of gabbing back and forth about, you know, whatever's going on, and you know, whatever experience as a cop, and
their repartee, I'm sorry, was like just so bad.
Terrible.
It was just it's like Joel Edgerton will say something and then Will Smith will shoot it down, and it's like we're all supposed to laugh because he's shooting it down, and he's like, he's annoyed by this guy, but he just comes off as a jerk. Like, there's no depth to him at all, aside from him just refuting everything that Joel Edgerton says. It gets so annoying in
Joel,
one note.
The problem is, I think I like Joel Edgerton in the part. I think he did a good admirable job as like this orc who's trying to make it in, you know, kind of man's world kind of thing. I don't think partnering him with Will Smith was a great idea, because Will Smith is a great has great chemistry, and when you get great chemistry, whether it's like Martin Lawrence and Bad Boys, or even Tommy Lee Jones and Men in Black, and Will Smith can really play well off somebody else who can also play well off him, and it just, there was no chemistry at all between the two of them, and that's what it needed, and that's what, you know, separates the really great buddy cop movies from the really terrible buddy cop movies, is that connection and that chemistry, and it just wasn't there, and it was like Will Smith was acting in one movie and Joel Edgerton was acting in another, and it's not
a boring movie. Like, there's a lot that happens. There's a lot of action in the film. Like, you would I think most people will be entertained to a certain extent, but mm-hmm. none of that action and none of those things that happen lead or come together cohesively to say anything.
Right.
Like you said, they set it up with all of these images that are, you know, very kind of relevant and contemporary. And then they just kind of drop all of those social themes for this really nonsensical fairy tale plot. I don't know.
It is so nonsensical. They have to stop 30 minutes before the end of the movie to explain everything that's happened so far
so
and what has
exposition.
To happen next.
Yeah.
It is bizarre.
So my theory is that Max Landis started this script with an idea of what he wanted to say. Yeah. You know what I mean? Obviously wanted to comment on that kind of those racial themes, I guess. Mm-hmm. Just didn't have the skill to like tie it all together and say something profound. So just kind of, you know, wrote it as he went along, not realizing that he was writing himself into these plot holes, I guess. I don't know.
Well, it's odd that, you know, mentioning Suicide Squad, which was an Ayer script, but mm-hmm. I think they suffer from the same problem, which is they become sort of the worst version of these of what these movies are. Mm-hmm. In Suicide Squad, it starts off with an interesting idea, which is you take all the people that the heroes typically fight, you put them on a team and say, okay, now you're going to do a mission for the good guys. We know you're a terrible person, and we know that you would likely, you know, do terribly bad things if you were let out free in society, but we're going to put you under the command of one soldier. We're going to send you out to do this mission, and if you're successful, maybe you'll get some time off your sentence, but in the likelihood that you fail and you die, we're not exposed.
Right.
And then it becomes this generic superhero thing with a blue light in the sky and CGI gobbledygooks and plot threads that don't go anywhere.
There's this woman that they save early in the movie who doesn't say anything.
There's a whole character who's introduced and then is immediately killed.
Yeah.
And it's just, to prove that the situation was serious. But yeah, it was an interesting idea that he lost the thread for very, very quickly.
Yeah.
And I wonder, because there was a lot of discussion when this sort of came about, just how much of control Landis had in terms of, you know, what the keeping to the script. And he apparently there was some negotiating with Netflix that, you know, I will sell you the script, but it has to be made this way, and it has to, you have to keep certain things. And I wonder if Ayer was allowed to play with those tools, as mm-hmm. you said earlier about, you know, the grittiness and keeping it to that level, whether he might have made the adjustment.
It did. It crossed my mind at one point that maybe the script was not actually set in Los Angeles and it was David Ayer's idea to set it in Los Angeles, just because he's done that before with other films. And that's where he grew up as well, South Central Los Angeles. So, but again, it's like there are like moments where it feels like a David Ayer kind of gritty street cop film. Mm-hmm. And then it's just, he just lost the tone completely, as you said.
Yeah. And the whole plot is around, if you can call it the plot, but it's around they rouse this, like, I guess it's like a magical crack house or something, but somebody's there with a magic wand and you can basically, I think it was one of the characters, Ward, which is Will Smith's character, Jacoby, says that a magic wand is basically a nuclear weapon that grants wishes. And so when you kind of cue it up like that, you're kind of setting certain expectations high in terms of what the capability of this is. And that never pays off.
No. And the whole term bright is to refer to the only people who can touch the wand without dying.
Right.
And without giving too much away, I will just say that the twist at the end is truly one of the most absurd things I will see.
I saw it coming.
Yeah.
I made a note like maybe half hour in, like this is what the twist is going to be. And it was. And the twist doesn't pay off at all.
No.
It just happens and then you go to the end of the movie and it has no consequence on the plot at all.
And there's a typical Star Wars, everyone's getting a medal for a job well done scene at the end. And it's like, come on, man. What did they actually accomplish? Nothing. I didn't even find Will Smith's character to be that likable or sympathetic. You know what I mean? Like, he was doing some pretty, like, he murdered, like, cops in this film. And then he's trying to, like, bargain his way out of it. It's like,
that's kind of the first place that the movie lost me. I was kind of with it until that point where they find the magic wand and they call for backup and all, and the other members of his squad arrive. And then all of a sudden, like, every other member of his squad is not just racist towards the orc guy, they're terribly corrupt.
And
they're conspiring against other cops. It's like, really? There's going to be no consequences for this?
Yeah, it's... I don't know. It's, again, though, like, I feel like a lot of people will forgive those things simply because it looks nice. There's a lot of cool kind of effects, and there's a lot of action. But the plot is truly, truly
there's
horrible.
Been a lot of forgiveness, too, because this is one of the reasons I wanted to talk about this and review it was because of this dyad that's erupted, that you have critics, like, shoveling dirt on this movie right, left, right, and center, and you have people...
I'm shoveling something else over.
But you also this movie also has its fans.
Right, yeah.
And a very, very vocal fan base who's, like, given it 4 stars, 5 stars. And it mirrors what happened with Suicide Squad, which was something else that was panned by critics but had its audience. And there was a very passionate audience, including the... If I remember correctly, there was one guy who brought forth a change.org petition to shut down Rotten Tomatoes because it gave it such a bad score.
Right, yeah. I actually remember that, yeah.
Yeah. So it's David Ayer, whatever his talents are, seems to have cultivated this very passionate fan base. And I can't, you know, there's something about it that feels a bit off to me. And I think it was kind of summarized in the beginning of the film where it comes up with the title cards. And one of the title cards is, I'm not sure whose production company is, but it's like called Trigger Warning Entertainment.
Right.
Which feels really terrible to me, like a really terrible name. Because, you know, a trigger, people do have actual triggers. And maybe it's a term that's a bit overused, but it's a real thing. And there's something about that. It's odd that we're talking about a title card, but there's something summed up there, whether it's Ayers or whether it's Landis. I have a feeling that it's probably Landis given some of his online comments on Twitter.
See, I'm not really familiar with him as a person.
Yeah.
I don't know what, like, how old is he? Is
Landis?
He, yeah.
He's got to be late 20s or 30s.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I suspected he was kind of young.
But I mean, something about that just says...
There's something condescending about
it. Yeah, there's something condescending and kind of... I don't want to say alt-right-ish, but I will. It's you know, it feels a bit icky. Like, it feels a bit Gamergate icky to me, but... yeah, it just it fosters this kind of us versus them mentality that seems to have come out with this film and then Suicide Squad, where it's just like, you don't get it.
Yeah.
And it's like, well, yeah, we don't get it. That is kind of the point of a criticism, is we don't get it. But, you know, it's not that we're personally out to get David Ayer. It's not that we're personally out to get Bright. I would have loved it if Bright was good.
Yes.
I would have enjoyed that very much. And it's getting a sequel, so, you know, good for them.
Yeah, so the sequel has already been confirmed.
Yeah.
This was the highest streamed, like, Netflix film, I believe.
Yeah.
It was 11 million viewers after, like, 3 days.
Yeah, which would be translate to, like, $100 million of box office opening.
Oh, really? I didn't know that. That's crazy.
Like, with an average ticket price of, you know, $9 or $10.
Right, yeah. So it brings up this argument that it's like, you know, success on Netflix apparently means something else, or it means it's a different definition of success when you're talking box office numbers. It's like, as a lot of people watched it, then they obviously, you know, have a taste for it.
Well, they also, you know, the box office numbers are public numbers. They are out there. You can find them. Netflix tends to keep its... viewer data under lock and key. The fact that they came out and said 11 million people watched it, that's an exception to what Netflix usually does.
Yeah.
Usually they'll just say, yeah, it was successful, so we're greenlighting a sequel or a second season or what have you.
Right.
So it almost feels like there's a bit of a justification there on the part of Netflix that they were trying to prove that, you know, again, against the critics, you know, the critics don't get it. Our audience found it and they are pleased. And so we're going to greenlight another one.
And I even said after the movie was done, I was like, I'm willing to give that kind of premise a second chance if they write it well and if it's directed well.
Yeah. If they.
So if that sequel is, I will give that sequel a chance. You know what I mean?
Right. Sometimes, you know, you can establish the world and you can come back and like really play with it in a part two. Even if you stumble the first one.
Yeah.
But having said that, I've been burned by that a lot of times. You know, the Underworld series.
It True.
Feels like every Underworld movie is setting up the next Underworld movie, and then it never pays off. And it's the Resident Evil movies, too. The last Resident Evil movie came out last year.
Mm-hmm.
And the one before that ended with, like, all the main characters gathered in one place, and one of the evil characters going, "We must team up for the final battle." And then the next movie starts off, everyone is gone except Mila Jovovich. and it's like, oh yeah, we had that final battle and then everyone died and now it's just me again. Yeah. And it's
troll warning, that should be the company, production company there.
Yeah, so I mean, yeah, I too am willing to give a second chance, but again, I feel like we do this a lot with these movies that were like, okay, well, the first one was terrible, but they were trying to establish a world that, you know, Law and Order, for example, doesn't have to worry about world building. But
yeah, and just on like just on another note, the tension, there's like a tension that exists between them when the movie starts.
Yeah.
And it makes like no sense. it flashes back to the scene where Jacoby is getting a burrito and he's not able to save Will Smith from being shot by some robber coming out of the store with a shotgun who shoots him. And so he holds this grudge against. It's like, yeah, but he was like 30 feet. Like there was literally, the way it was filmed, there was nothing he could have done. You know what I mean? It was so ridiculous. I was like you can't honestly blame the guy for what just happened, can you? Like,
well, I think the blame was also because he was being targeted because he was riding along with the orc cop.
Fair enough.
That because the orc is... he's non-clan affiliated,
right?
So he's kind of an outcast. So I guess him being on the LAPD is a double affront because he's not a caste orc and he's, you know, sleeping with the enemy, as it were. He's
I thought that's where the film was going to go.
Right.
Is Jacoby going to align himself with the orcs who are kind of rebelling against the police or whatever, or is he going to stay loyal to the police? I was like, there's an interesting avenue that you never went down either.
I'm glad you mentioned that, because there's a scene where they're before the plot really gets going, where they're driving around on patrol and they come across human cops like beating a couple of orcs, and they're just and they pull up on it, and Will Smith makes a comment like what are you going to be today? You're going to be like an orc, you're going to be a cop. And I thought, okay, so are they going to back up these police officers, and Jacoby's going to have to, you know, make a decision. Is he going to like join in the beating of his fellow orc people, or, you know, is he going to have to make some sort of moral judgment here? But no, they just drive away.
They just drive away
to the next thing, which is actually that scene that we played with the guy with the sword, which introduces the...
was the very next.
Yeah.
Or at least preceded it shortly after.
Yeah.
Is it just me or did the orcs like look weird too? It looks like they just had patches of green on their face, like there was moss like growing on their face. I don't know. It just bothered me.
The makeup didn't bother me.
Oh, okay. The orcs, like the elves, like, okay, whatever, but the orcs...
the elves were very
elf-ish.
Yeah.
So then there's like this FBI elf team that investigates like magic
the
only
magic
crimes or whatever.
Yeah,
the magic task force.
Which I thought was going to go into they're just like kind of regular. They're like Johnson & Johnson from Die Hard. It's just, I thought that was going to be something, because when they say that the wand is a nuclear weapon, I thought, okay, well, maybe those guys are like the equivalent of Homeland Security.
Yeah.
Because what would the reaction be if there was a nuclear weapon just in the back of somebody's truck in L.A.? You know, there would probably be some stuff happening, but I mean, that's one of various threads that nothing comes. I wish there was more about the elves, because I did find that like an interesting aspect. Also, you know, other races too.
Yeah.
I understand that, you know, because there's only 2 hours, you can only focus on so much. But
yeah,
you know,
You know what it reminded me of, or do you know what it made me think of, was District 9, which is a movie I believe perfected the, like a very important social theme with a very entertaining film. And if you were not really into the social aspect of the film, you still got a very awesome sci-fi film. And I felt like that's what this film aspired to be. It aspired to be a simultaneously entertaining and insightful social commentary.
I don't think you have to know a lot about South African politics and society to get District 9. I think you can know like maybe the basics, you know, in terms of apartheid. But I think the more you know about it, the richer it is.
Yeah.
And I think this could have played in a similar way. I you know, if they had,
even how there's like, it even like comes dangerously close to District 9, how there's like this crime boss in a wheelchair and he's looking for the wand.
That's right.
And then he ends up like, that's exactly what happens in District 9 with the guy, the Nigerian guy in the wheelchair. It's like, I don't know.
I didn't even think of that because he has like tattooed writing on his face. And I'm just thinking to myself, what is David Ayer's thing with tattoos on the face and writing? And
it must be a South Central Los Angeles thing. Maybe.
It must be, but it's so distracting. Anyway, if you want to check out Bright for yourself, it is on Netflix right
sure
this minute.
Has,
I think it is worth checking out. And it's, I think it, you know, it certainly sounds like maybe Netflix's most successful movie effort thus far. So, you know, and it's the first of its kind in terms of like the blockbuster on streaming. So, you know, if worth checking out for that, that kind of like cultural relevancy. But
I couldn't imagine seeing that in theaters for whatever reason. I'm not sure why. It just didn't have the theatrical kind of, I don't know, grandiosity. Is that...
Sure.
I don't know.
Having said that, it might be an interesting experiment to, you know, if it's possible to see it on the big screen at some point.
True.
That out. So, all right, we're gonna leave Bright there, and we're gonna get a bit smaller now, real small.
I see what you did there.
So we're gonna come back after the break with our review of Downsizing, and until then, I thought there was really only one song that could get us in the mood. Something from the 80s. Something from an artist with three names. And I think you might know what it is.
Just please don't put me on the spot.
I wasn't going to put you on the spot. I was leaving something for the listeners to figure out.
All right.
Anyway, we'll be right back with our review of Downsizing. You're listening to End Credits here on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus, and community.
And purchase the Regency level estate. Remember, that's a 12,000 square foot equivalent home on the 1.5 acre equivalent lot.
Right.
So, taking a look at your current debt, your retirement, and your other savings, you are at $152,000 in equity. People, that is a very comfortable number.
Comfortable? That doesn't sound like nearly enough.
Yeah.
Well, no. See, you have to look at this column, Audrey, equivalent value. In Leisureland, your $152,000 translates to $12.5 million to live on for life. I mean, come on.
Wow.
So, what do you think? Would the Regency level be your first choice, or should I show you something a little more deluxe?
Honey, why don't you just go ahead and pick? I just want you to be happy.
That's a good husband. Take a look at this.
And that was a clip from Downsizing. It is a new film from Alexander Payne, and it stars Matt Damon, Christoph Waltz, Hong Chau, and Kristen Wiig. And we were talking during the break about John Cougar Mellencamp, but also about being disappointed in things. And Vince chose downsizing out of a number of options presently in theaters, so he's very excited to see the film. And I think if you recall from earlier in the episode,
yes,
he sounded pretty disappointed in this as well.
I would concur with that, yes. And Alexander Payne, one of my favorite directors working today. I think he's one of the best directors working today. Sideways, I could honestly watch that movie every day for the rest of my life and probably not get bored. But
no more Lowe.
I like really started to question him as a director after this film. I was like, is he going down the Billy Wilder path where he's trying to be, to keep up with the kind of current kind of trends or state of cinema and just not being able to do that?
Mm-hmm.
I don't think so, actually. I don't know. He's thrown around some idea, or he's thrown around the idea of doing a horror film. It seems to me like he's done kind of with the road comedy movies through quirky America type films, and maybe he's ready to kind of branch out into something else.
If he wasn't done before, he should be done now. Because I think with downsizing, if you're familiar with Election or Nebraska or The Descendants or About Schmidt, you know, here we have another sort of lovable loser from middle America having a midlife crisis. And it just so happens that his crisis is his decision upon how to address that crisis. I'm going to shrink down to 5 inches tall and live in some place called Leisure Land.
Yeah.
As a short person, or as a small person, I should say.
So they are, Matt Damon and Kristen Wiig are married. They're having some serious financial troubles.
Yeah.
It starts out with this. It starts out like with a very kind of like pedestrian like first act. It's bizarre.
Yeah.
It starts in this like facility where these, I think they're Swedes. They invent the actual technology.
I think they're from Norway.
Okay, yeah. Norway. Yes, Norway.
They're Scandinavian,
and then yeah, there's the cliche. There's the cliched scene where they discover the technology, and then they have this embrace. This loving moment where they're like, we did it. And then it cuts to like 10 years later. And then they've kind of advanced the technology. And then it cuts to like even later.
Yeah.
And that's when we're introduced to Matt Damon. And it's like,
don't you think that narrative style?
Yeah. It's like, don't you think you could have compressed this somehow into a like just a little bit shorter? And then when it kind of gets into the whole science behind the downsizing, that's when it really starts to get entertaining for me. That's when that's when I really like it sunk its hooks into me, and I was like, okay, where's this going? And then the very same issues happen in the third act. I found it's just not able to use that premise to,
well, it keeps skipping to like, it's almost like a greatest hits of a movie idea where it's like they want to keep getting to the scenes they want to do. And I hate that when it's like 10 years later, 5 years later, and you're like, where the heck are we now? And even when it introduces Matt Damon's character, it shows him taking care of his sick mother. And then after that, it cuts to like 5 years after that.
Yeah.
And it's like, no, stop. Let's start telling a story here instead of doing vignettes. Even
it's like they even do like a classic like Independence Day scene where it shows, you know, the cliched
where the White House pulls up.
Where it shows the stereotypical like you know, cultures from around the world as they discover the technology has been introduced. Cuts to the tribe in Africa sitting around a radio, cuts to the, you know, Tokyo where everyone's looking at a big screen, and it's like, come on, like you couldn't have a more creative way of doing those things.
Everyone would be looking at their phones now, even in the African tribe.
Yeah.
I think you're right. Where they kind of start explaining the science. And the science isn't even explained. Like, there's no techno babble in this.
No.
It's very kind of, I want to call it kitchen science, because a lot of the instruments and things, like, we're making like kitchen noises, like there's a ding on the device that does the shrinking. That sounds like a ding on an old fashioned oven.
And then he's pulling like a big lever, like it's a 1950s like sitcom to actually activate the downsizing thing. Here's my problem, though. Okay, if you're gonna do that, if you're gonna do like the kitchen science,
yeah,
then you should stick with it. But this movie gets into kind of heavier science. It's like there's this net around the town, the downsizing town, to prevent everyone from getting like raised because you're smaller. So they obviously have incorporated some scientific thought into it.
Yeah.
But it's like, do one or the other. Don't mix and match like real plausible science with phony science.
Fair enough. But I mean, I kind of liked it too. I kind of liked the whole thing about the whole detail about having to go into the stopping by the dentist before you get shrunk, having to go back to the dentist after you get shrunk because of all your fillings and all your partials and your bridges and things. And I have to take all that out. And of course, there's a line later about somebody, you know, one of the people we meet, her husband and her were shrunk. She was successfully shrunk. He was not successfully shrunk because of the place they went to was cheap, so they missed a filling and his head exploded.
Right.
And which is when you after you go through the whole process and you see the shaving, and because he can't, it's, for some reason it's all organic, but you can't have any hair going through the process.
Yeah.
But that's fine. It's, but it's so it's very like it's very kind of old fashioned 1950s, or just kind of like a THX quality to like seeing all those like careless people going through the process. And but yeah, it's funny to have it like sort of explain just enough without having to get into the mechanics of it. It's just like, hey, we shrunk people, we can do it now. And that's all there is to it.
Yeah. And then Matt Damon eventually moves into his, I wouldn't consider it a spoiler. Like, Kristen Wiig and Matt Damon are both planning on doing the operation together.
Yeah.
And then Kristen Wiig backs out at the last minute,
yeah,
leaving Matt Damon alone in, what is the town called again?
Leisureland.
Leisureland. Why do I keep wanting to say Pleasantville? Okay. Leisureland.
Other movie.
So then he starts meeting all of these quirky characters in Leisureland, one of which is Christoph Waltz, who plays this kind of zany, hard partying, guy.
Very European. I think, honestly,
who serves no purpose in the story, who ends up doing nothing to alter the story.
Very true, but I think it's the best use of Christoph Waltz I've seen in a long time.
Fair enough. It's he certainly looked nice in his silk shirts. I'll put it that way.
Oh yeah, he looked like he was having a great time.
Yeah.
And plus his sidekick is Udo Kier, and I'm so glad because I'd forgotten Udo Kier was a thing.
Yeah.
And I can't imagine someone who like play like some ubiquitous European sea captain than Udo Kier. It's so great when you just like, yes, that is my boat. He's great. The Kristen Wiig thing, I think it's supposed to be a spoiler, but I think the movie itself sets it up so that it's not a spoiler, because the final shot of her when he's going, because apparently they have to do men and women separate, or that's just how they do it. But so he goes off first to start the procedure, and the camera kind of pans very slowly away from his point of view, and it's like, okay, well, that's the last we're seeing of her. It was pretty obvious.
Yeah.
And it's such a, it was also a waste of Kristen Wiig because.
Yeah, because she never comes back in the film.
She never figures in any, and it's like she's, and the way the movie, again, with that putt, you know, this scene, 5 years later, this scene, 10 years later, she doesn't really leave a mark at all.
Yeah.
Because she's just kind of introduced in one scene as Matt Damon's wife. She, you know, because it's 5 years later, his mom's died, now he has a wife. And so, what?
And then there's like a scene, it's like he's working on an old school like tax machine, and then he's rubbing his head like he's stressed, and it's like, give me a break, man. Like,
straight
what is this, 1940s? Like,
straight out of Leave It to Beaver. It was like the word Cleaver. It's like, oh, mother, I'm not sure how we're going to make
it. Oh, I wonder if they have financial troubles. Yeah, I wonder if that's what that symbolizes. So then he gets there, and then it it pulls like a Bright for a bit there, I feel. Like,
it pulls a Bright. I hope that's a thing.
It foreshadowed. Christoph Waltz starts talking about, like, you know, this illegal kind of underground business. He's like this small guy that's doing these like smuggling or whatever. He's involved in illicit activities.
He's a rum runner for small things.
Right. So. The advantage being you're so small that the authorities aren't going
they don't
to
give
like.
A damn. Yeah.
So I thought that's Matt Damon was going to kind of
yeah.
team up with him on that. But again, it just like didn't go anywhere. And Christoph Waltz doesn't really do anything except provide some comic relief.
I affirm it was great comic relief. But you're right. I did think that was like it's going to be like a small Lucky Logan or something.
Yeah.
Or a small Logan Lucky. I always get that backwards. But which would have been interesting. But you're right. Like it starts introducing so many things and then kind of doesn't bother with them again. And I think the Christoph Waltz thing was also meant to introduce that the idea that there's this caste system. Because the way I can't remember his name. I can't remember. I'll just keep calling him Matt Damon. When Matt Damon and Kristen Wiig keep get pitched the Leisure Land, it's like, oh, like, yeah, in big land, you're swimming in debt. But when you're small, it turns out you're a millionaire.
And I know.
It's this big sales pitch. And they go to this show where Neil Patrick Harris and Laura Dern are kind of like the spokespeople. And she's like, I went shopping today and bought all this jewelry for like $3.95.
Yeah.
And everyone's like, oh, I gotta get into this place. And of course, it's sold as it's basically a bill of goods, because obviously not everybody in a place is going to be able to live the life of leisure. You know, that society is going to be built on some kind of marginal
hierarchy or whatever
labor,
yeah.
Right, and then so we meet that, and we meet that through the character of
Nhoc Lam, or yeah. Hong Chau's
yeah
character.
Nhoc Lam, I did not want to screw it up, because I think this character gets treated horribly in the film. Because I like the character, and I think the actress did a great job,
yeah,
but like listening to her talk in this pigeon English, like I was watching an yeah. episode of MASH from 1974, did not sit right with me.
Right.
And so it's through her. She was like she's like a Vietnamese dissident who was in jail. And again, this is something that's in the background of the film, that you have nefarious governments using shrinking technology to get rid of, you know, people who are protesting the government or the enemies of the government.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what Vietnam has done in this case. And she was smuggled to the United States with a bunch of other Vietnamese dissidents in a TV box, because she says TV box every 5 minutes. And she's the only one who survived.
And she has one leg for some reason, too.
I think it was because of her injuries and while traveling via box.
Oh, okay.
It's
fair enough.
Yeah.
Fair enough.
Yeah, it's blink and you'll miss it. But it's through her, you know, Matt Damon is taken to basically like the slum area of Leisureland.
And that's when the tone kind of...
Right.
Or you see where they were trying to say with the film.
You see what... I'm not sure if Alexander Payne was trying to say it.
Right, yeah.
But I think it was something he wanted to say, because you literally... The bus literally drives through the wall of Leisureland, and then there's this like shanty town on the other side. First of all, driving through the wall, incredibly on the nose for 2017, so thanks for that.
Yeah.
But... yeah, and it's this like shanty town where all these like poor and lower caste people.
And I was like, live. Do you honestly expect me to believe that this would honestly happen? That there would be this, you know?
Well, who shrunk these people and how
yeah,
they pay for it?
Especially because she said in the interview, like, "Well, I can't do the procedure because my husband had an injury or something,
right?
Or whatever, and people with injuries cannot go through the procedure.
He had a hip replacement, so
it's like,
yeah.
How is this guy in the wheelchair getting into this slum in Leisureland and
yeah.
whatever? And it's like, it just gets so preachy and so on the nose. Yeah,
yeah, it." There are a lot of questions about the slum. It's like, why is there like an outside of the wall part of Leisureland? It seems a bit bizarre to me. And yeah, like, were these people, you know, kind of forced? You know, is there some kind of like underground market of like
the whole
indentured
thing just,
servitude?
Yeah.
Because that kind of, I mean, the film comes around later and we meet the guy who invented, or we see him at the beginning, but we also run into him again in the latter in the film. And he talks about, like, oh, it breaks my heart that people are, like, misusing it. It's like, dude, people are misusing it all over the place. There's a slum in this leisure land. It's, you know, where people are living in, you know, ad hoc facilities while all the rich jerks on the other side of the wall live in McMansions everywhere.
So then it gets like, it goes totally off the rails at that point. It's like the world is about to end and we all need to think about using debt, like downsizing. To save the planet as opposed to this kind of gimmick where you just get rich. And that's when it gets even more pretentious, and that's when it even gets more preachy.
Yeah.
And the guy that invented the thing at one point says,
I was too late.
The crocodile survived 200 million years with a brain the size of a pea, and human beings only survived whatever, 200 million years or whatever it is. It's like... Okay, that example's a little off base.
Yeah. Well, yeah, it's that's in the background of it that, you know, it's there's a scene where I can't remember who plays the guy, Matt Damon's old friend, but you know, where they're kind of talking, he's like, "You know what? Forget about all that save the world BS, you know, because that's kind of the point is everybody down. If everybody in the world downsizes and they lay out that scientific meaning of the being, they're like, We'll make the transition to small over 200, 300 years, and, you know, Bob's your uncle, Fanny's your aunt. And, of course, in that beginning scene, they introduce a number of interesting concepts that housing prices in the big world are crashing because nobody's buying houses because more and more people are going small. And, you know, there's labor shortages because people are going small and going into...
So then the small people get this kind of marginalization treatment... Yeah. As lesser citizens, and there's this conflict.
One scene where the guys, you know, they're having a goodbye party for Matt Damon and Kristen Wiig, and he's like, "Oh, so you guys are going small? Tell me something. Why should small people have the same vote I do?" And it's like, "Oh my goodness!"
Like this isn't on the nose at all. Yeah,
it was more than a little on the nose. But I think if he took one of those ideas and explored it, and it's not like I think he. Payne and Taylor were writing this since after Sideways. Then they put it aside.
Yeah.
To do other things because they couldn't crack the story. And it's like, well, they still hadn't cracked the story.
Yeah, no.
And I think this could have gone into a number of interesting directions. But they hit upon one, the environmentalism. And it kind of like, I forget it. And then they hit on the, you know, the class system in this place. And it's like, forget it. And then we go hang out in Christoph Waltz's apartment and drop acid for 15 minutes.
Yeah, that was so random.
And then we wake up on the floor and it's all good. And Christoph Waltz is like, hey, you know, I'm smuggling Cuban cigars in Leisureland, whatever. it's like, I think there's two directions you could have gone with it, which is just like have fun with small people, like do the Incredible Shrinking Man thing. There could have been a way to Honey, I Shrunk the Kids this.
They were obviously trying to avoid that whole avenue of like, oh, look how funny it is that this cookie is twice the size of me type thing. So
I did love the bit, though, when he wakes up in the hospital
and she has
and the nurse has the saltine and she's like, I bet you're hungry. And she brings it in and he's like, what? And she's like, we do that joke with everybody. And I, you know,
that was actually good. Yeah.
I would do that joke too. this is the thing you do every time somebody wakes up. And
they didn't have those saltines in the slum. Apparently that would have fed like
300
people. Yeah.
But apparently you have to go to Chipotle and get all their leftovers.
Exactly.
It kind of breaks my heart in a way, this movie, because there was a lot of opportunity, I think. And I think, he doesn't want to do the Honey, I Shrunk the Kids thing, which is fine. But, you know, there were a lot of... It feels like he was trying to do a Wes Anderson riff, and, you know, it's just like, this world is just crazy. We're just going to do a little sightseeing trip through this crazy world and meet all these crazy characters. And then it's not going to mean much, and maybe somebody's life changes a little as a result. But
we're gonna, the ending. Matt Damon has to make a pretty big decision at the end, and the way they do it is just so bad. It's like it's the his speech at the end is taken right out of like a Lifetime like made for TV movie. It's just horrible.
That's giving you too much credit. But it was it was like it's the typical romantic comedy ending, like the running through the airport to catch someone before they are gone forever. And
but they don't earn it at all. No. Like the idea that the idea that like love here and now is more important than, you know.
Right. Well, I mean, it's littered all over the place, right? And as we said at the top, this is like one of Payne's themes. It's, you know, these men who feel like they're useless, they haven't lived up to their potential, and not seeing what's possible around them, and they're so focused on, you know, what's over the next horizon. And again, on the nose with this, it's just like, you know what, you kind of know where it's going, and from the minute he arrives in Leisureland without his wife, and he's like, well, what is all this for? Now I have this big house, and now I, you know, we're getting divorced, so I'm not as rich as I'm going to be in Leisureland. Now I'm a cog in a machine. Now I'm at the Land's End catalog trying to get people to buy Mauve instead of taupe or whatever the heck. Life has its drudgery, and I think that point is made. But, you know, the message that, you know, life is going to suck small just as it sucks big, you know,
was not successfully
that was not successfully translated. And because we take all these side trips into these social issues, we never really come to understand what it is that Matt Damon's character is looking for and what he thinks he hopes to find, whether that's, you know, going to the original little colony in Norway, or whether that's, you know, living as a rich jerk in Leisureland. You know, what is he trying to accomplish? What is he trying to change about his life? Like, just the status of it? Like, is it important to be important to society? Or is it important to be a group, you know, a small group? I don't know.
I don't demand that, like, you know, everyone abides by the critical screenwriting theories or whatever. But this he really did need a goal that he was working towards, because it just got so meandering. You were like, what are you working towards? What is the ultimate payoff here?
Yeah, and it doesn't really pay off. And I, when the scene like fades to black and the credits roll, I was like, that's it?
And I was like, I was like, if they're going in the direction with Hong Chau and Matt Damon that I think they are, then they need to do some better job, or they need to do a better job with the chemistry that they have right now. And they didn't at all. It was just so painfully awkward to like to watch. Maybe that's what they were trying to say. I don't know. Like, that's
life is painfully awkward.
Yeah.
Thanks. I didn't know that, but thank you. I'm surprised they went there, because there was really no sign that there was any kind of romance between these characters, any kind of potential romance. Like, he kind of falls into becoming her sidekick through kind of klutzery.
And then he becomes kind of the secondary character, and she's leading the story rather than him, kind of, which is disappointing. Yeah, it's I don't know. It's... I mentioned this with David Ayer earlier in the episode, how I feel he's getting too far away from his wheelhouse, which was the gritty kind of cop movies. Not to kind of peg him as that, but maybe just the gritty kind of...
He needs to get in touch with his strengths. Yeah.
Yes. And Alexander Payne, for me, it seems very obvious what his strengths are, which are these, you know, very human black comedies.
Yeah.
That's what he excels at. And
I mean, Election is something that's aged very, very well, if not better than when it first came out.
Yeah.
And I think I haven't seen Sideways in a while, but
he's also been adapting. That's the other thing. He's been adapting books and other work for a large portion of his career.
Yeah.
I think this is probably the first original screenplay that he's come out with since his first film.
It might be.
Didn't he write About Schmidt? I think he wrote
it. He might have.
Yeah. But anyway.
But I mean, About Schmidt was like his third or fourth film too.
Right, yeah.
So, you know, he's kind of thoroughly explored this milieu, I think. And if he is going to do something different now is the time, because downsizing wasn't quite different enough.
Yeah, I heard some comments in the paper that he made about how he loved Get Out, and, oh, I would love to try to do a horror film. Don't they make a lot of money? And I'm thinking, dude, I think you missed the point of Get Out. It's like...
Jordan Peele was like, I'm going to make so much bank with Get Out.
Yeah.
yeah.
And also, it successfully tied its social themes together very well. You know what
exactly.
I mean?
Exactly. That was a successful movie.
It blended its genre with
It was a critical
those,
and commercial success.
Yeah.
I am kind of vexed. This ended up in there was a lot of praise from some critics, and I'm kind of vexed by that. It's like, I don't expect everyone to have the exact feelings I do, but like, there are people who had like rave reviews for this.
Even the comments coming out of TIFF were like, oh, this is fantastic. And
Well, you can't believe
it. I was under the impression it was a serious awards contender.
Yeah. Don't believe what you hear at TIFF, kids. That's the lesson for today. Anyway, we hope you like our show. Now we're back. We're back with the weekly shows. You can stay connected to us at our website, endcreditsradioshow.com, End Credits Radio Show on Facebook, and End Credits Radio on Twitter. Vince, where can people find you online?
Facebook. I'm still kicking around Facebook. Vincent Masson.
And you can find me later today here on CFRU for Open Sources Guelph with my partner there, Scotty Hertz. You can find me on Twitter and Instagram at Adam A. Donaldson, or go to guelphpolitico.blogspot.ca. Stay tuned for more great programming here on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus and Community Radio. And we'll be back here next week, Thursday at 10 a.m. for more End Credits. And we will see you then.